Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The Drive Nation Podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
When I look back, Andrew, at the podcast that we've recorded so far, I see that we've done specials on McLaren Automotive, on Aston Martin, and on the Porsche 911 specifically. Kind of all quite top-endy stuff. So I wanted to address that and bring in some more real-world content to this podcast, because actually those three podcasts that I've listed, they're not necessarily representative of the kind of cars that you and I write about, drive, the kind of cars that we own, the kind of cars that we scour obscure European classified websites for. Is that fair?
More than, yeah. I mean, there's always this massive disparity, never greater than within the realm of motoring journalism, between, you know, the presented sort of standard of living and the actual reality. So we may spend our time, or at least some of our time, driving these amazing hypercars and so on and so forth. But actually, A, because we can't afford anything else, but B, also because there is genuine proper interest down in the cheap seats. Yeah, the cars that we think about, and particularly the cars that we own, bear very, very little relationship to the cars that we tend to find ourselves writing about in print.
Exactly. So one of the ways that we're going to bring in, you know, some more real world stuff is to talk about the cars that we've owned. That's what we're going to do with this podcast. I mean, you've got a very long and colourful history. I'm not going to steal your thunder by doing this, Andrew, and I'm not going to mention the cars either. But you've sent me a list of all or most of the cars you've owned with a very brief sort of description. It's a potted history of your car ownership. And I just want to pull out a few highlights because it sets the scene for the next 50 minutes or so. Okay, spilt a pint of cream on the back seat, making it unsellable. Next one, written off by a motorbike. Next one, destroyed an RTA when I didn't see the car in front because I was fiddling with my new graphic equalizers. Next one, written off showing to mates at Goodwood. Never completed a journey without going wrong. Written off outside my flat. Disintegrated. And sort of on and on it goes.
Yeah, yes. This isn't necessarily showing me in the polished professional light I like to be seen, but by all means, proceed.
Well, I think that those are the highlights. But, okay, well, I think we should start off at the beginning with your car ownership history, and we'll knock off some of the highlights, and then I'll get on to mine, which is sort of shorter and less colourful. But there are some highlights in there.
Only because you're about 100 years younger than me.
Yeah, well, there is that. So should we start at the beginning? At the top of my list, I've got a Fiat 126.
Oh, yes. The smell. That's what it was known as. All my friends. It wasn't known as a Fiat or a 126 or anything. It was just known as the smell.
The smell.
Yeah. It was. I mean, I'd been very lucky because where we grew up was in the countryside and there was space and we actually had a couple of fields. So I actually owned a car, if you could call it that. I owned the remains of a Morris Minor, which just about functioned. And when I could afford the petrol, I would just, from a very early age, just drive round and round and round this field until eventually it died and wouldn't go again. And my father, who used to spend a lot of time away on business, he'd come back at the end of the week and just go to the Hertz desk and hire something and bring it home. It was always something cheaper, but it might be a Mark II Escort. And once it was an MG Midget. And his idiot sons would just take this hire car and just drive it round and round and round these fields for the entire weekend. And he'd take what very little left was that back to Hertz on Monday morning to get on the plane to go off to wherever he was going next. And they never, ever queried it. And the damage we did, I can remember the Midget. It had these things which in the, this would have been sort of late 70s, early 80s. It had these 5 mile an hour impact bumpers. And the idea was you could drive it into anything at 5 miles an hour. Or less without damaging it. And there were sort of telegraph posts sort of going up and down the side of one of these fields. So we'd literally spent the weekend driving it into these telegraph posts just to see whether we could damage it or not. I mean, we behaved appallingly. But yes, back to the smell, the 126. This was a car that was given to my father by somebody because they'd literally, a pint of cream had been upset on the back seat of this and had been allowed to soak into it. And the stench was such that they realised the car was entirely unsaleable. So they gave it to my father, who in turn said, if you can face the smell, you can drive this thing. And as none of my mates had cars and I had a car, my idea was that, you know, the girls would find me much more interesting than them because I was mobile. I may have miscalculated somewhat in that regard.
Yeah, the reality of that?
Yeah, the reality of that was that I was usually alone in the car.
Talk us through how that thing smelt on a hot summer's day.
Well, it's surprising, actually. It had a sunroof and it had windows that wound down. And I didn't care. I mean, it's like all those things, isn't it? Do you ever walk through duty-free shops, the perfume bits, and just wonder how anybody could work in that smell? And the answer is you just get used to it. And I did. It just ceased to matter to me anymore. I mean, and compared to being able to get about, do my thing, and drive, you know, drive a car, I mean, who cares? Not me, certainly.
What was the 126's fate?
I drove it into a tractor. what was I doing? Yes, there was a tight right-hand corner, and I was taking the line, and it was quite a big tractor, and it was a low hedgerow, so you'd have thought I would have seen it, but I didn't. I think I was quite lucky, actually, because the tractor was quite a large, hard, heavy thing, and the 126 was anything but those things. And and it didn't even have an engine in the front, so there was not a lot between it and my feet, but somehow I emerged from that unscathed. I imagine I got my feet out of the way quite sharpish.
So the car was off to the scrappy after that, was it?
I don't remember anything of it after that, so I presume so, yeah.
Okay, let's clip along nice and quickly then. Your first 2CV.
Oh, yes. My first, well, it wasn't my 2CV. It was actually my father's 2CV. I think he must have bought it to replace the 126, although why he thought that was going to suffer any less undignified a fate than the 126, I can't imagine. So that was... Yeah, that was a lovely car, 2CV 6 Special. Specials were always the nicest 2CVs back then. It was a car built in France, disc brakes, so the best sort of 2CV. And it had a little bicycle speedometer, black roof, white car, beautiful thing. And I was racing, I lived in Jersey at the time, and I was racing around the island to go and meet a mate for dinner. And at the end of minor roads, they have these things called yellow lines, which are basically give way signs. And I somewhat missed my braking point, so I slid out into the major road. Unfortunately, at the same time, the bloke on a bike was coming down that main road, and he literally just drove straight into the side of the 2CV. And I was haunted by the sight of this bloke flying through the air and landing, so far as I could see, on his head. And we shouldn't joke about this stuff because, you know, sadly, you and I both know people who have not survived things like that. And I genuinely thought that I'd killed the bloke, but I couldn't get out of the driver's side because that was all buckled. So I kicked my way out the passenger door and went over to him. And to my utter surprise, he was not only alive, but he seemed to be kind of okay.
Wow.
And in Jersey, they have a thing called a parish hall inquiry, which is basically like a sort of local meeting before they decide whether whatever it is you've done wrong needs to go to sort of proper big court. And they can, if it's very minor, they can deal with it there and then. And so I sort of turned up at this thing 3 or 4 days later. I was surprised to see the bloke turn up on the bike. Okay, the 2CV was written off, destroyed, gone. But he literally, the bike had been off the road for 3 days at most, which just tells you a little bit about how flimsy Citroens were back then.
Well, also, if he was hoping he'd be prosecuted, he didn't really do himself any favours there. He should have arrived limping, you know, out the back of a taxi or something.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, you, like me, underestimated the bloke. He spoke in my defence.
Yeah. I thought you might say that.
So he literally got there and he went, the lad made a mistake. He's never going to do it again. He's been frightened, completely witless. I think he suffered enough. And, you know, it was an enormous miscarriage of justice, because if ever there was a case of dangerous driving, that was it. And I should have been nailed for it. In fact, yeah. I got fined £5 for failing to observe a yellow line.
Oh, wow.
And that was it.
Well, all credit to the motorcycle rider.
All credit to the bloke, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's a good opportunity then to leap forward to the present day, because despite everything that you experienced back in Jersey in a 2CV, you adore those cars and you have one now.
I always have. There is something, what is that phrase? Yeah, simplicity is genius, or genius is simplicity. And if you look at that car, everything from the flat formation engine to the, you know, not entirely un-McLaren-like interactive suspension, all independent suspension on it, you know, the space, the lightness, I just get in those things. And on one level, it's kind of all I need a car to be. And my 2CV, which is very different to the 2CV I destroyed, but, you know, I've got a very old one now, 1958 car with a it's a 12 horsepower 425cc engine.
Whoa, throbbing.
It could barely get out of its own way. But, you know, I have had drives in 1,000 horsepower hypercars that I've enjoyed less than coming back from a pub in one of those.
I understand. I really do. I've never driven one. What would I sort of experience?
I mean, they are quite a particular thing. They're not actually, those old ones are not particularly easy cars to drive, because you've got to keep them on the boil.
And the technology is half a century old, more than.
Yeah, but I mean, that's all right, because, you know, the pedals are where you expect them to be, and, okay, the gear lever goes in and out rather than sort of up and down. But it's, you know, that bit, it's not difficult. It's just, it's keeping it smooth and keeping it mobile and just in. But it teaches you how to drive well, because it teaches you to carry speed. I mean, every mile an hour is kind of, you know, it's hard earned and preciously protected. It kind of makes you think about driving. And that's one of the things I love about it.
Someone posted a photo on Twitter the other day of a 2CV at dawn in the countryside. It looks like it might well be French countryside. I think it's a Ripple Bonnet car. It's a misty morning. There are chickens pecking around.
And the boots up, is that the one?
Yeah,
it's beautiful.
It just tells such a lovely story.
You just want to be there, don't you? You just want to be there. I mean, I wish I could communicate better what is so wonderful about those things. I mean, I have a very old, not quite as old, but nearly as old Fiat 500, which is a really, really nice thing. It's a very clever car, and it's good fun to drive. But it's not the 2CV. I don't know why, what it is about 2CVs, but, you know, if there's one car I own today, which I know I'll never sell, it's that.
I'm surprised. I knew you had a Fiat. I think I've seen you not driving it. I've seen you at a pub with it. But it's amazing to me that you fit. You're a tall guy.
Yeah, but, you know, well, hey, I'm very used to folding myself up to get into cars. And, you know, and let's not forget, you know, the Fiat 100 that I have today is not even a particularly distant relative of the Fiat 126 that I crashed, whatever it was, 37 years ago. So, yeah, and also these things are remarkably space efficient. You know, they don't have these enormous seats in them. They don't have massive A, B or C pillars. You know, everything is small. Everything, you know, there's not an engine in front of you, so your legs can go there.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, you'd be surprised. You know, people go on about the incredible space efficiency of the Mini. But, you know, the Fiat 500 was out first and was a much smaller car and would take just as many people in probably the same amount of discomfort.
Yeah, cars like that, they make a really good case for putting the engine way out back, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
I wonder if that'll ever catch on.
Doubt it.
Okay, right, let's get back to the list of cars that you've owned. I want to hear about the MG Metro and your new graphic equalisers.
Oh, the MG Metro, yeah. So I don't want to get more, but I actually inherited that from a fairly close relative who died before her time. I mean, by my standards, this was a fast car. You know, it actually would certainly indicate 100 miles an hour, which, you know, if you've grown up on, you know, Fiat 126s and 2CVs, is, you know, probably 40 miles an hour faster than you've ever seen anything go in your life. And it handled quite well and everything else. And but I mean, as all young idiots did back in the whenever it was, you know, in the 1980s, you know, your music machine was almost as important as the car. I was obsessed with graphic equalizers, and I didn't have any. but there was a company called Sparkomatic that used to make very cheap sets of graphic equalizers, which had lots and lots of flashing lights and levers that went up and down. And the only place I could see to sort of mount it was underneath the dashboard of this thing. And so it was while I was ferreting around under said dashboard with my graphic equalizers that the car in front stopped. And yeah, the first I knew of the accident was when I hit the car in front. I didn't even see it, let alone have time to brake for it. And yeah, sadly, that was the end of the Metro. But all this, okay, I would just say for Go anybody on. Who's jumping to conclusions about me and my lamentable lack of driving skills and appalling approach to safety on the open road, all these accidents, so the Metro, the 2CV and the Fiat, all three of them all happened within a year of me passing my test. Honest Gov.
That first year, probably the most dangerous one. Hearing all these stories just makes me think that when I was 17 or 18, I wasn't trying hard enough. I didn't get up to any of that stuff.
Yeah, so how old were you when you first crashed a car?
Well,
you're not going to tell me you haven't crashed anything.
No, I have. I mean, it's debatable, really, what counts as a crash. I think we've said this before. If you can drive away from it, I'm not sure it really is a crash. and even if you have to be towed out by a farmer's Defender 90, you know, if you can drive away from that, I don't think that counts. I've had only one that really destroyed the car, and it wasn't actually my fault. So, you know, touch wood. Yeah, I don't have any tales like that to tell.
No, well, good. I mean, yeah, they're great fun in the telling, but then they're not much fun in the experiencing. So I'd keep it like that.
Yeah, I'll do my best. Okay, well, I remember a few months ago on Drive Nation, at Drive Nation _ on Instagram, go and check it out. You wrote a very sort of insightful post about the car that you learnt to drive in.
Yeah.
Not the one that you passed your test in or that you did your lessons with your instructor, but the one that you really learned to drive in. And that for you was a 205 GTI.
Yeah, it was. So this would have been 1985. So I would have been 20. And because I was too thick and lazy to get any A-level grades worthy of the mention, I never got to go to anything as posh as a university. So I just went out and got a job. And the only job that I thought I could do and was able to get was in the city. I had a few city jobs and I was useless and got fired from all of them. But for a little bit, I had a tiny bit of money. And so I went and spent, I think it was £6,495 on a brand new 205 GTI, which you won't remember because you weren't even alive, but then it was absolutely the thing because it always.
You must have been the proudest man on earth.
Oh well, I mean, you can imagine. I shudder to think how young I was. I was 19 or 20, I guess. I had a brand new 205 GTI, and up until that time, it had always been all about the Golf, hadn't it? I mean, the Golf was the thing, and then things like. What came along? I mean, there was the Astra, wasn't there? And there was that hot 130 TC Fiat and that sort of thing. But the 205 came along and it just rewrote everything. And so I went and got one of these things. And I drove it about the place and I thought it was all rather good fun. And then my oldest brother told me about a track day going on at this place called Goodwood, which was then pretty much a derelict site. You know, former racetrack, but you know, nothing had raced there for 20 years. And you know, a few cars had done testing down there, but anyway, I went down there in my 205 to drive around a racetrack in for the very first time. And I went, I think someone must have showed me around the track, but the first time I ever drove on the track, I went out the pit lane, screamed up to the first corner, turned in, and spun.
Oh, if only we had GoPros and camera phones put them in.
And I just didn't understand it. One moment I was going around a corner, the next moment I was seeing my tire tracks. I was facing the way I can. And it was unintelligible to me. I didn't, you know, I thought something must have broken on the car. Or maybe I'd hit some oil or something. So I tried it again in another corner and spun again. And what I was doing was I was going in very fast and then thinking, oh, I'm going in a bit fast. And so I'd try and slow down, which is never a particularly good idea in a 205 GTI, particularly if you were doing sort of 80, 90 miles an hour and you hit the brakes. And yeah, so what I did, that all rather sort of cowed me, and I didn't do much the rest of that day. But then I can remember talking to my brother, who he was racing alphas and that sort of thing at the time, and doing quite well. And he said, you need to go and understand car control. And, you know, I can tell you what to do and everything else, but you'll never understand it better if you go and see for yourself. So all you need to do is go and find a big roundabout somewhere very quiet and just drive, you turn into the roundabout at a sensible speed, apply whatever you think is the right amount of lock, and then go around the roundabout just coming on and off the throttle and see what happens. So I thought, all right. And there was, well, there still is a big roundabout underneath the Westway in London. And I went up there at 2 a.m. And there was nothing around. And that's where I learned how to drive. And that's where I learned about, you know, controlling a car on the throttle. And what I didn't realize, you didn't have to be, you know, on the limit or anything. You could just drive this car around, constant steering, constant throttle. And then if you accelerated a bit, it would peel away from the apex. And if you lifted off a bit, it would bite back in. And this was just like a complete revelation to me. Mm. And yeah, I mean, that I've always thought of that. I mean, before that, I had operated cars. But, yes. You know, in that car, at that roundabout, is where I learned how to drive.
Yeah, it's such a distinction, isn't it?
Yeah, completely.
Well, Goodwood, in your sort of potted car history, is a bit of a running theme. Because we've come on to the KTM 7 Super Sprint.
Yes. Okay. So yeah. So once I sort of forget the chronology. I have to try to work out which cars came when. But I think that once I'd worked out how to control a little hatchback going around a roundabout, I clearly concluded that I was a world class driver. Yeah, exactly. So I could go and get myself a proper sports car. And I was still sort of in the city at the time, and I'd always been and remain to this day obsessed with Caterhams. I can remember, you know, one of the earliest memories of any car is just walking down a pavement with my father and seeing what would have then been a Lotus 7 just coming down the street beside me. And it wasn't going fast or anything dramatic, but I just remember seeing that shape and seeing how low it was and seeing how wide it was and just thinking, that's just it. That is just where I want to be. And it kind of has been ever since. So anyway, I went and bought this KTM 7 Super Sprint, which was, it had a Ford Crossflow 1700 engine in it. So yeah, standard 1600 engine, bored out 1700, couple of big Webers on the side, 135 horsepower, probably 500 kilos, live axle, you know, old spec, tall sidewall tyres. And I went back to Goodwood for another track day. But obviously, knowing all I knew at that stage, then, you know, I was going to be a complete driving legend. And I so confident was I brought all my mates with me. And they were standing in the pits looking down at the chicane when I decided to show them how to drive a car. Yeah, I just trod a bit too hard. And that was the end of the Caterham. I went backwards into the earth bank on the outside of the chicane so hard it had a little roll cage that when my head went back it split the helmet I was wearing. So you can imagine that'd be my skull. And yeah, very sad. I love that car. But I'm not actually sure if it was written off. What I was sure was that I couldn't afford to repair it, and so I sold the wreck back to Caterham. It may be out there somewhere.
Oh wow.
B858NPH, I think. I've never looked it up. I should do. I suspect it's not, because I suspect they threw it away. But yeah.
That's job one after we finish recording this podcast then.
Exactly.
Just as a brief aside, can you kind of paint a picture of what Goodwood was like at that time? Because clearly racing had long since stopped. You know, it's contemporary racing had long since stopped there, and historic racing was a long way off starting again. So I think you said it's a kind of tumble down, scruffy old circuit.
It was. You put it very well. It was a tumble down, scruffy old circuit. But, and this is where I admire what the Duke of Richmond and his team have done. You know, you go to the facility today, where such an enormous amount of money has been spent over time, and it's such a hallowed place now. But you know what? You get on the track and you drive around it, and it's the same thing that I drove around in the mid-80s, and it's the same thing that people drove around in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. You know, in the only regard, frankly, that actually matters, which is as a thing to drive around, as a challenge to a driver, it is now what it's always been. And I think that, you know, how many other circuits can say that?
It's so special, isn't it?
Approximately none, really. It is so special. You're absolutely right.
Okay, right, back to the car history then. I think this was another City Boy purchase of yours.
Oh, God.
The Lotus Esprit S3?
The S3. See, I don't know why, but I have such fond memories of these cars. And, you know, the S3 in particular was an unmitigated disaster.
Nothing heals quite like time.
No, well, I bought it from a bloke called Barry.
Of course.
In the Fulham Road. And I'm not going to go into numbers now because however many decades later, I'm still genuinely ashamed of this. But I spent a huge amount of money I didn't have on it. And I guess I was just some young idiot who, I'd love to say it was because I was so into the purity of the driving experience. But the fact is, I just wanted to show off to girls. And I bought this thing. So it was an X plate. I probably bought it in 86. So it was 4 years old. It had done 30,000 miles and it was a ruin before I got in it. I think I said in my notes to you that it never completed a journey without going wrong. Now, I don't know that's strictly true. It might have gone to the shops and got back without going, but it certainly never completed a journey of any note, let's say, of more than 20 miles. Without something going wrong. Sometimes it would be a little thing, like one of the headlights would just sort of start winking at passers-by. Sometimes it was side of the road, you know, call the recovery guys. And it never, ever failed to let me down. And I just loved it. I just absolutely loved that car. And years and years and years later, I drove another. And sometimes when you go and drive cars from your youth, you get in them and you just think, what on earth was I fussed about? What a pile of whatever this is. And it wasn't. It was still it's still Morris Marina door handles and everything else. But as a thing to drive, it was just lovely. And I'm sure if I drove one now, I think the same way. They were the most exquisitely balanced cars. I loved it.
What was the engine in yours?
It was a 160 horsepower, 2.2 non-turbo, just the sort of standard Lotus twin cam straight four of that era. I couldn't afford a turbo, but I didn't want one because I just didn't like the noise that they made, didn't like the turbo lag and everything else. And an S3 was everything. You still got the big BBS golden silver alloys and the big fat tires which you got with the turbo. So you know that was fine by me.
Okay, but back to the most important point: what did the girls make of it?
Actually, it's possible I was growing up a bit. I suspect not. It appeared to make a bit of a difference.
Oh.
Yes, I certainly didn't spend. I certainly spent less time alone in that than I did in the 126.
Well, there we go. The Esprit worked for you then. Okay. Well, let's
to a limited, rather modest extent, but yeah, I guess.
Okay, I'm just going to run through the remainder of your list, and I think we should pick out two or three. To have a chat about. You've got a Mark 1 Golf GTI, a Renault 5 GT Turbo, a Porsche 993 RS, a Chevrolet Camaro race car, Caterham Superlight R, it's on and on your list, Aston Martin DB2 4 Mark 3, an Alvis Silver Eagle, Land Rover, this list is endless, Land Rover Series 3, Porsche 911 2.7 Rep, and the other ones we've discussed. So which ones are sort of closest to your heart of that lot?
Oh, blimey, that's a question. The thing is that I think there must be a little shard of something I see in my brain, because although I look back with such immense fondness on all these cars, there aren't that many that I wish I hadn't. Well, I wish I hadn't crashed all of them, but I there aren't many I wish, you know, that I sit here thinking, oh, why did I sell that?
The
993 RS for one, you know, that was a great car, but you know, because of the way you and I earn our livings, you don't get time to drive those sorts of cars, which is why, well, finance being one, but practicality being, the reason that I just own cheap old sheds now is because, you know, you can just jump in them and take them to the pub. You don't sort of think, oh God, what's the point of having this car? Because if you don't do more than 150 miles in it. I've completely forgotten the car wasn't on the list. I had a 968 Club Sport until quite recently.
Of course.
And I sold that for exactly, I sold that for that reason. I sold the 2.7 replica for that reason. I sold the 993 RS. I can remember going to it. It must have been in sort of March or April time, and seeing that the clock was still set to British summertime. and thinking, well, what is the point of having this thing? And these cars, the Aston was, I mean, the Aston was a beautiful car. And maybe I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But, you know, once I got this job, you just can't drive cars like that. So they went. I think the one that I do really regret selling is the Superlight R. So this was I think it would be called an R400 or something similar today. So it was, you know, this was 20 years ago. And it was a car that I spec'd myself. It's probably the only car, just only cars I've actually bought new. So the Peugeot I bought new, and I think that might be the only other one. And I sat down with Jez Coates, who was at Caterham at the time. He was their sort of chief engineer. And, you know, I'm quite a big lad. And so I didn't even have a seat. I had a molding, which not only meant I'd be really comfortable, but also meant nobody else could drive the car, which was like a sort of, you know, absolute, you know, slam dunk for me. And, you know, it was a black car with a yellow stripe. Caterham had never done one of those before. They did plenty after. And it was just fabulous. It was, you know, I used to chase Harris out to the Nürburgring in it and go round and round and round. It was faultlessly reliable. It spent so much time on tracks. It had those wonderful Avon ACB 10 tyres on it, or wonderful in the dry. So, you know, you could drive around the outside of most things on it. And, yeah, I just have feelings of unalloyed joy about that. And the sad thing is I can't even remember why I sold it. It may be somebody made me an offer. I know that it was. In fact, I drove it again after it. I was at a Spa on a track day, and I just saw it there. And the bloke came up to me and said, "Would you like a go?" So I did, and it was just brilliant. Yeah, I really, really missed that car. And if I think about all the cars that I haven't got in my shed right now, I think more about Caterhams than anything else.
That's really interesting. So you found you had sort of more utility for that car than the 993 RS.
Yeah, because the 993 RS, actually I sold that to finance racing. So I sold the 993 because my brother and I wanted to go historic racing, and we wanted to buy something that was really powerful and rear wheel drive, for which the bits were cheap. And back then, probably still today, that all added up to a Camaro. But you know, I couldn't afford that and have the 993. So I sold that, but I wasn't using it. But I did use the Caterham because, I don't know, I mean, the Caterham was just great, whatever you did with it. I mean, it had proper weather equipment in it, and you didn't sort of feel that you had to drive it. You know, the 993, you felt you kind of like had to drive it across Europe, or at least to the north of England, before you could justify getting it out of the shed. Whereas the Caterham was just one of those cars. That's why I want another now, because I just know I'd use it and really, really enjoy it.
Yeah, totally.
God, I'm gonna have to stop myself going and buying one after this conversation.
It's going to be a costly podcast for us both.
It may be.
Now, bearing in mind that we were supposed to be keeping this real world,
yes.
Can you tell us briefly about the Aston Martin you owned?
Oh yeah. Well, actually, it was real world in that I didn't pay a lot of money for it, which is, of course, the most stupid thing anybody can do with an Aston Martin. It was, you know, I should have seen the warning signs. You know, I was a motoring journalist at the time. I'd reasonably experienced, but I just became. I was really into the Aston Martins that they built in Felton before they moved to Newport Pagnell to do the famous cars, the DB456 and so on. And before that, it was all DB2 based cars. And the ultimate of those cars was this thing called, it's got quite a torturous name, called DB24 Mark III. Some people call it a DB3, at which stage people who know Aston Martin's steam start coming out of their ears, because a DB3 was something else altogether. But it was just sort of, this doesn't sound terribly sexist, a proper gentleman sports car. And it was the later Astons were all much more sort of in the grand touring vein, but this was a proper sports coupe. And hand built, even in a way that you know, the later Newport Pagnell cars weren't. And it was just the most. I love the way that it looked. It had that wonderful W.O. Bentley designed straight six twin cam engine in it. And it was, you know, the entire plan was perfect, apart from the fact that it was just the wrong car. There was a reason it was cheap. It was shot to pieces. And, you know, it overheated and things fell off it and it started to corrode. And, it's sad, really, because it was a lovely, lovely thing. And is the most special car I have owned. But I can remember the relief when there was a German banker came over for some reason. and bought it. And I can remember the relief I felt when he just sort of drove it away, and thinking, thank goodness for that, because it was bleeding me why I wasn't. I was too frightened to use it anymore, and it just needed to go somewhere else. And he actually blew it up completely on the way home. He didn't seem to mind, because he was going to give it a nut and bolt restoration, which I think it's had, and it's gone to a much better home than I was ever able to give it.
Now, that's a very cool thing to have in your back catalogue, though, a really special DB24 Aston Martin.
Yeah, no, it's good.
Okay, now, I think last one from your side, Andrew. I want to hear about your Series 3 Land Rover, because it's parked outside your house now, and it's also the car that you passed your driving test in 1982.
Yes, it is.
So you'll never get rid?
No, I can't. I said earlier in this podcast that the 2CV is the only car I'll never sell, but I don't really feel the Land Rover is mine. It's the one thing that is, very much... It's hardly an heirloom, but it's certainly a family car, in that, my father bought it because he had three idiot sons all learning to drive at approximately the same time, and he just wanted the slowest, strongest thing that money could buy. He wasn't a farmer or anything else. He didn't buy it for any of the reasons that most people buy Land Rovers. He just wanted something incredibly slow and incredibly strong. And that was it. And so... yeah, and so the Fiat 126 was sort of my car, but the Land Rover was the car in which I learned how to drive on the road, and I passed my test in it. And then when my father passed away 23 years ago, I had it, and I've still got it. And the thing about it is, it's not kept really as the others, as a sort of recreational take to the pub type car. It works. I have a few sheep and it carts them around, and I need to move quite a lot of wood from place to place every so often, so it does that. I filled it up with rubbish from fields the other day, I mean, it's just a working Land Rover. And of course, where I live, which is quite remote, every so often, the snow comes. And it's really, really interesting when that happens, because all the guys with their brand new Range Rovers, they just disappear. They don't exist. And all the people who've got Defenders and Series Land Rovers hidden away in sheds, which don't usually come out in the summer, suddenly that's all you see on the roads. And I love that. I just love that. I love, being out in the snow in the Land Rover is a great joy to me.
I've got no desire to track down and own the VW Polo TDI that I passed my driving test in.
1.4 TDI?
Oh, yes.
Fantastic. Turbo, presumably.
Absolutely.
Probably felt quite quick, didn't it?
It did feel, yeah, very torquey. It felt quite punchy. Oh, dear. Right. We're going to move on to my cars now. But before we do that, I just want to ask you if you remember back in the day, when it was new, or perhaps a few years after, do you remember test driving a pop-up headlight Nissan 200SX?
Oh God, yes.
And what do you think of it? What do you remember of it?
Going sideways.
Go on.
To oversteer, I did a group test with that, a Celica and a Volkswagen Corrado for autocar, and the Corrado won it because it was. It was just the most capable car and a really good fun car to drive. But if you just want to go and have a laugh, pop up headlight 200SX. I think the one after that was even more leery. But yeah, you just went sideways in it. Terrific thing. Is that one of your early conquests?
That's exactly. Well, yeah, the going sideways is exactly what I had in mind. So I was 18 years old and I'd been given 1800 quid for my 18th birthday.
Wow.
And obviously, being a car obsessed idiot, I went and spent more or less every penny of it on a car. Day to day, I actually shared a modern Ford Focus with my mum. So I could go and buy something that I actually didn't have to depend on day to day. So I went and bought this S13, I think is the correct code name, pop up headlight Nissan 200SX in very dark blue. It had done a few miles, but it was actually a really lovely car. And right from
can you remember the essential sort of stat? I'm just trying to remember. Was it a 2 litre turbo or something like that?
Maybe it's a 1.8 turbo.
Yeah,
but it was 170 odd horsepower.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah.
Which,
blimey! I mean, that's more power than I ever had when I was 18 years old.
Well,
I'd have been backwards through a hedge in that in a heartbeat.
Well, I mean, I have to fess up here and now that I barely drove the thing. It's a sorry tale, this. I'm not proud. But it's a reasonably entertaining story. So I bought this car with this sort of half-assed intention of turning it into a track car. And so I bought the wrong car from the off because it was too nice to, you know, to be messed about with like that. And the fact of the matter is I couldn't afford to insure it, and I knew that was the case, but I still went ahead and bought the car because I was a total idiot, and I just thought, that's fine, it can sit outside my parents' house and I'll slowly turn it into a track car, and then I'll find a way to drive it on circuit. You know, that was my master plan for this thing. And I without the first idea of how to go about doing these things, I basically spent one summer's afternoon stripping out this lovely immaculate interior and hacking away at all the sound deadening that was, you know, sort of glued to the shell.
Had you done any sort of courses or anything to qualify you for preparing a car for track use?
No. Is there such a thing?
Well, I don't know. Well, I mean, a basic sort of, you know, bit of mechanical engineering. So you just decided you're going to attack your car.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't have the first clue. Someone, my friends at the time, and even now, find this whole story hilarious. So if they're listening, yeah.
Did you have a toolkit?
Not really.
You weren't sort of using a bread knife and that.
Well, possibly. No, I think we had like a socket set and stuff for removing, you know, the rear seats and seat belts and so on. I did not have the first clue what I was doing with this thing. And I stripped it out, as I said, and I bought this enormous big bore sort of free flowing exhaust.
Good
which
lad.
Sounded awesome. I have no idea what it did to back pressure, but it sounded fantastic.
Probably not a very good thing, but
yeah, exactly. Although the way it sounded, I was delighted.
Yeah.
And I think I bought some springs and dampers for it and maybe some uprated brake pads. I don't know. It was a.
Did you fit all that stuff yourself?
No.
No. Good.
No. I can't remember what I did end up fitting. The exhaust certainly went on, but I actually can't remember about the rest of the stuff. If I even got around to doing it, I probably only drove the car 20 miles or something in the whole time I had it. I spent 1,500 quid on it and a load of money on other stuff. And it sat outside my parents' house. I probably had it for maybe 18 months or something, maybe 2 years. Sat outside my parents' house for that whole time. And the interior gradually grew mouldy. It was such a pity. And I eventually, I had to just sell it. You know, I wasn't doing anything with it. There was a few hundred quid in it, so I sold it for probably half the money I bought it for, and it was gone.
Plus the amount of money that you spent on
exactly.
it, presumably.
Well, exactly. So, it was utterly hopeless.
Have you ever worked out to yourself, and I suggest if you haven't, don't, but have you ever worked out what its actual cost per mile completed has been to you?
No, I'm not going to. Please don't do it on the hoof now because it'll just upset me.
No, but, could someone please do it? Okay, 1,800 quid. I think you spent about the same again. So let's say it stands in your book $3,500. Okay, and you did 20 miles in it.
It wasn't. I spent 1,500 quid on the car and a few hundred quid on bits and pieces. So
okay,
it's not quite that much.
Okay, well call it a couple of grand for 20 miles. That's 100 quid a mile.
It's 100 quid a mile. Oh, well, thanks. I thought we weren't going to do that.
Sorry.
Oh, that's a pitiful return, isn't it?
I've probably done something almost as bad myself at some stage.
Someone once described it as the kind of misguided enthusiasm that car enthusiasts should applaud. And I think that that's maybe charitable, but sort of fair enough. Anyway.
Yeah.
But I feel more upset about the whole thing now than I did back at the time when I was 18 or 19, because you just can't find these things for sale anymore.
No, they've all gone, haven't they?
Yeah, and if you find one, it's been really sort of distastefully modified. And finding a really tidy, clean car like the one I had for, you know, about a week before I started hacking away at it is just impossible now.
Yeah, and it's all down to people like you.
It's all down to people like me. Oh,
yeah.
God.
It is your fault.
I'm surprisingly sort of morose about this whole thing.
So you should be.
I wasn't expecting that. Oh, God. Okay. Oh, I feel equally sad about the car that I owned after that was gifted to me by my granddad, which is a very, very sweet thing for him to have done, although it was a Vauxhall Vectra automatic.
Oh my God! And you're owning up to that on this podcast. That's, I mean, I knew you're brave, Dan, but I mean that's a new level.
I didn't keep it that long. That was a sorry car.
Can you think of, you remember when Clarkson reviewed the Vectra on Top Gear?
Yeah.
And he did an entire review. He did the entire review. I don't think he actually. He didn't say a word. It was a silent review.
Oh.
Can you think of? Do you? I was about to ask you if you had any memories. I mean, is there anything about it which was remotely memorable?
The most memorable part about the whole ownership experience was when I went to collect it from my granddad, and he was talking me through all the controls. This is how you indicate right. This is how you indicate left. Yes, granddad, I've got that. And he went down to the automatic gear selector, and he said, "You got park, reverse, neutral, drive, and this button with S, which I knew was." For snow, you know, if it's snow, you'd press that button and it would hopefully allow you to get rolling. And he said, this is S for if you want a speedy getaway.
That's launch control for an automatic Vectra.
So that was brilliant. I remember that bit quite fondly, but
yes.
The car was hopeless. And so, yeah, I mean, to my eternal shame, I've had my name on the V5C of a Vauxhall Vectra.
Yeah,
which means
I wouldn't be earning up to that.
No. Okay, so after that, I had an E36 BMW 318 IS, which I liked, but the car was a total dog. I bought badly, which is a bit of a running theme, actually.
And yeah. Good car in theory, though.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun in that car. It was a BMW, so it's rear-wheel drive. I think not the first one I had, because I had the 200SX, of course, but the first rear-drive car that I used regularly. And I learned a lot in that car. You know, I enjoyed driving it in the rain and just feeling the car move around a little bit. The
nice engine, too, in those as well.
Well, not the one I had, because I had to swap it. The engine blew, so I had to put a new one in. And that was nice. But the car was sadly just a bit of a pup. But I had a lot of fun in it. After that, I had a Mini Cooper S, a very early R56, so one of the first of the turbocharged ones.
Yeah.
Which was a nice car. I had a great time charging around in that thing. And I had it for probably a year, year and a half.
So what sort of year would that have been when it was built?
It's a 2007 car.
Yeah.
VU07 NMK.
There you go.
It's weird how we remember these things, isn't it?
Yeah, good cars, those.
And then from there, I've owned a couple of other bits and pieces, nothing worth really discussing. But from there, we kind of get to the car I have now, the Alpine A110, which is, that's kind of worth talking about for a few minutes. Andrew, you did the media launch for the A110. Down in France somewhere, wasn't it? I actually didn't do that launch, but can you sort of set the scene? It was on a weird circuit that I've never heard of before.
Yeah, I still can't remember its name. Obviously there'd been a lot of hype about it. I mean, we'd known about the existence of the car for, but it was probably 5 years, because it surfaced originally, as you will remember, as a sort of JV with Caterham. And then it went separate ways and everything else. I think I've talked about car park cars on this podcast before. If I haven't, I've done it on Drive Nation and Instagram. And what I mean by a car park car is it's a car you get in, and before you're out of the car park, you know that today is going to be a different day. There is something about, even at the first possible experience at very low speeds, it's about the way the car addresses the road, the way that it steers, the way that it feels. You just think, wow, okay, this is different. Okay, this, you've got my attention, and I'm not even on the public road yet. And I just remember driving and just thinking, I mean, there is a reason it is the only car that Drive Nation has ever awarded 10 stars to, because for those of you who may not be completely familiar with how we review cars on Drive Nation, largely because we've not been able to review any for the last 10, 12 weeks, we don't offer stars in the same way that others do, in that, you know, if it's the best in the class, it gets the maximum. We don't do that. If it's the best in this class, it'll get 9 out of 10. If it's really, really good, it'll get 8. And if it's, you know, pretty impressive, it'll get 7. To get 10, you need to change the game. you know, being the best isn't good enough. And the only one that I've driven in the nearly 2 years we've been doing DN is the A110. And I drove it on this on a fantastic route through France, and then we got to this really tight, twiddly little circuit. And I can just remember having all the fun in the world. It was wet, which helped. And the balance of the car, the feel of the car, it just took me back to all those things that I loved about driving cars from the get-go, regardless of how expensive they are, regardless of what the badge on the front is, you know, regardless of how much horsepower the engine has. It's just about feel and balance and the joy of driving. And, you know, and of all the cars that I've driven the last couple of years, it's the A110 that expresses those feelings best, and I'm not jealous at all that you've got one.
Well, I clearly agree with everything you say there, which is why I do own one. I've got my Thunder Grey A110 Pure outside, and it's a gorgeous little thing. But I actually drove the A110 for the first time something like 12 months, maybe even 18 months before that international media launch. I was at Evo at the time, and Alpine wanted to get a small group, I think maybe only three or four journalists, to come and drive it over a period of time. So we go and drive it 18 months out from the launch, 12 months, 6 months, and get a feel for how the car is progressing.
That must have been a fantastic thing to do.
It was superb. So I first drove it when it was a long, long way from finished. And I was totally underwhelmed by it.
Really?
I think back now, and the guys at Alpine, David Tuig and the rest of the engineers, they just said, be completely honest. And I now feel guilty for how hard I went in on the car.
Well, you're probably the reason it's so good now.
Well, you know, I was honest at least. We're driving a convoy on some quite narrow but really good mountain roads just outside of Barcelona, I think.
Did you have sort of rivals with you? Did you have a Cayman with you and that sort of thing? Or were you all just in A110 prototypes?
It was all A110s, but the lead car was a Mégane 275 Trophy R. Uh-huh. And I said to them, frankly, guys, I would have rather been driving the Mégane. they took it on the chin, fair play to them. They took it on the chin and wanted to hear why I said that. And the issues were, I mean, basically, we were fundamentally there to sort of think about the chassis. That's what they really, at that stage, wanted us to, you know, talk to them about.
Sure.
But the engine was so flat and the gearbox sort of so hesitant that it was impossible, you know, to overlook all that stuff. And yeah. I remember the paddle shift as well was so spongy and weird, like squeezing a liver. That's the image nice. That came to mind. And this is my little claim to fame. I've said this so many times, but I'll say it once more. I said to the guys that I thought it was too spongy. It should be more clicky, more switch-like. And they had actually signed it off already. That, you know, they thought that bit was all finished. And whether or not this is true, I don't know. But David Tuig is sort of generous enough to insist that it is true. On the back of what I said, they went back to their supplier and said, okay, we need to change the feel of the paddle shift and make it more clicky.
There you go.
And now it's the finished production car. My car has got a lovely sort of snappy paddle shift action.
It does. It does.
So that's
all thanks to you.
Wow. I'm quite pleased with that. That's my tiny, almost insignificant contribution to that car.
Yeah, so you should be.
But we were basically there to have a think about the chassis, and it was clear that there was this, you know, lovely, supple, fluid ride going on. But the steering was nowhere near finished, and it made me realise, actually, having, you know, driving the car then and driving the car now, how important, I mean, it seems obvious, but they hadn't finished the steering calibration, and it just made the whole car feel numb and sort of inert and uninteresting to drive.
Yeah.
And just by improving the steering, they unlocked all that amazing potential in that wonderful chassis.
Yeah, but it's the primary interface, isn't it, between man and machine? It surprises me how often people don't get that. Even things like, you know, the steering wheel itself, its size, its thickness, how squidgy the rim is. If you think about, you know, that's basically where the feel of the car comes through. And you know, to get that wrong just strikes me as being, you know, fun. You know, people who get that wrong can't have thought very hard about what drivers really, really want. Because if they had, and if they'd been drivers themselves, they just wouldn't have done it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that was my first experience of the A110. And, you know, pretty underwhelmed by it, but I suspected there was a load of potential. And most importantly, I loved what the guys were setting out to achieve with the car. I loved the whole philosophy behind it. And, you know, ultimately, even though I didn't think much of the car then, I think I'd bought into it already.
Wow. And then you did, literally.
Yeah, literally bought into it. Yeah. Oh, there
I was just going to say, I mean, it must be. I mean, I've done development drives, but I've never seen a car through at sort of various different phases. I think the only thing that the only claim to fame I have, which is rather less wonderful than yours, is I think I got the seat runners of the original XK8 extended by about a centimetre because I wasn't very comfortable in it. And they said, all right, we'll try and make it a bit longer. And that's it. But yeah, I mean, actually, when I get to do that sort of stuff, and it's the behind the scenes stuff, but you kind of appreciate just how good engineers are and just what rough raw material they get to work with. And also, I just feel sort of privileged that you can get to see all this sort of stuff. It's relentlessly fascinating to me.
Yeah, peer behind the curtain. It was a really, really cool thing to do. I was very lucky. Well, there you go. That kind of wraps up our combined potted car ownership history. A good mix of stuff in there, though. Some real cheap old snotters and a handful of, you know, slightly more top-endy stuff as well.
Yeah, but you know, the price paid and the enjoyment have are not related to each other at all. In fact, sometimes I begin to think they may be an inverse proportion.
Yeah, I think you might well be right there. Oh, that was good fun. I loved hearing your old stories of, you know, knocking around in old stuff and incidents and accidents and so on.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll leave that one there. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And please remember to rate the podcast, leave a review as well, wherever you get them. That really does help us. And subscribe as well. And make sure you're back next week to listen into the next one. Andrew and I will have a think about what we should talk about. But in the meantime, Andrew, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dan. I really, really enjoyed that.
That was good fun.
Cheers. All the best.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.